Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. 4 million dead. The world passes a grim milestone in the pandemic as governments prepare for a potential new wave of COVID infections from the Delta variant. Then, ballot battle. The fight to vote reaches a crescendo in Texas as the legislature renews debate over strict new laws. And a moment of reckoning. Canada confronts a troubling past after the discovery of hundreds of unmarked graves at the sites of former boarding schools for Indigenous students.
We've survived the Holocaust of our people, and now we look at the conditions of our community. So this country and these churches, they need to be accountable.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The U.S. military mission in Afghanistan will officially conclude on August 31st. President Biden moved up the deadline today from September 11th, and he defended the pullout in the face of Taliban gains. The president said the U.S. did not go to Afghanistan to nation build, and he pressed Afghan leaders to prove their mettle.
They clearly have the capacity to sustain the government in place. The question is, will they generate the kind of cohesion to do it? It's not a question of whether they have the capacity. They have the capacity. They have the forces. They have the equipment.
In Afghanistan, government forces said they drove Taliban fighters from a provincial capital in the north. Other reports said the militants have now seized a key border crossing with Iran. In Haiti, officials reported that police have arrested two Haitian Americans in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Two of the alleged assailants were turned over to authorities by a crowd in Port-au-Prince today. In all, six have been arrested and four were killed after a gunfight with police. COVID-19 has now killed more than 4 million people worldwide. That is based on official numbers compiled by the Johns Hopkins University. The true count is believed to be even higher. In the U.S., public health leaders said today that most new deaths and infections are occurring where vaccination rates are low. We'll return to this after the news summary. Organizers of the Summer Olympics today banned Japanese fans from the upcoming Tokyo Games in the face of surging COVID infections. Foreign fans were already banned. The new announcement came as the government declared an emergency in Tokyo, lasting through the Olympics. The head of the Japanese Olympic Committee acknowledged the event will not be the same.
The Tokyo Games were supposed to be a rare opportunity to feel the power of sports through the packed stadiums and united communities. However, it now must be held in a very limited way. I am very sorry for the fans and the local people.
The games are set to start in 2 weeks. We'll discuss all of this later in the program. Today marked 2 weeks since a condominium tower collapsed in Surfside, Florida, and the death toll has now reached 64. Another 76 people are still missing. On Wednesday evening, emergency workers held a moment of silence as they transitioned from rescue to recovery. Tropical storm Elsa is moving up the U.S. East Coast tonight and regaining some strength. Storm warnings extend into New Jersey and New York and as far north as Massachusetts. The system already killed one person in Jacksonville, Florida. It also spawned an apparent tornado that injured at least 10 people in Georgia. California called today for voluntary water conservation as drought grips more of the state. Residents are being asked to cut their water usage by 15%. Some of the state's reservoirs are already at dangerously low levels, with the summer just begun. 15 states today endorsed a settlement with Purdue Pharma over the opioids epidemic. The maker of OxyContin and its owners, the Sackler family, will release millions of documents and accelerate compensation to the states. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey praised the new terms to let the company emerge from bankruptcy.
Today's resolution delivers the most important things we've been fighting for, a reckoning that exposes the Sacklers' misconduct, strips them of their power, and provides money that will be dedicated entirely to prevention, treatment, and recovery.
10 other states have rejected the settlement. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration reversed itself today on a new drug for the memory-destroying disease Alzheimer's. It had initially approved broad use of Aduhelm. Now the Biogen drug will be limited to patients with mild cognitive impairment or mild dementia. The European Union has fined German automakers $1 billion for blocking emissions controls that might help address climate change. The companies are BMW and Volkswagen, plus VW's Audi and Porsche divisions. EU investigators say they kept improved pollution technology off the market. California lawyer Michael Avenatti, who once sued President Trump, was sentenced today to 30 months in prison. He had tried to extort millions of dollars from Nike. Avenatti previously represented porn star Stormy Daniels in her legal fight with Mr. Trump. And on Wall Street, stocks retreated after jobless claims rose slightly and investors turned to bonds over stocks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 260 points to close below 34,422. The Nasdaq fell 105 points. The S&P 500 slipped 37. Still to come on the NewsHour, how the Surfside collapse raises concerns about future investments in other buildings. Texas Republicans continue their push for restrictive new voting laws. Boomers respond to millennial complaints about the world they created, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Now, the staggering death toll from COVID-19. As we mark more than 4 million dead around the world, the actual number will likely never be known. And as the U.S. and other wealthy nations with relatively high vaccination rates begin emerging from the pandemic, the disease and its variants are accelerating in some parts of the world, killing more quickly than ever. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
As South Africa walks through the valley of the shadow of death, there is plenty of fear and little comfort.
The deaths are now not numbers on a news station. These are people you know. It's family, it's relatives, it's friends, it's colleagues.
Dr. Kgosi Letlape is a physician and activist in Johannesburg. He says while the U.S. is normalizing, the world and Africa are struggling because of vaccine shortages.
If it stays like that, not only are we not safe, the world will also not be safe.
On a day like today, it's difficult to comprehend. 4 million, equal to the victims of every war everywhere for the last 40 years, equal to the entire population of Los Angeles, equal to the entire nation of Georgia. Back in Johannesburg, these COVID patients are the lucky ones. They have beds in makeshift clinics set up by volunteer medics. South Africa's public hospitals are overflowing. Healthcare workers are overwhelmed. A third COVID wave is driven by an expanding Delta variant and shrinking vaccine supply.
That is our single biggest challenge right now. But a lot of the Western governments have stockpiles of vaccine. Let's release those to where they are needed right now and increase production of vaccines globally.
South Africa's story is a global one. As Delta spreads through countries with few vaccines, hospitalizations and deaths are at new highs. It took 9 months for 1 million to die, but the death toll rose from 3 million to 4 million in just 2.5 months. In the U.S., the Delta variant is quickly spreading. In some areas, it accounts for 80% of cases, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said today.
This rapid rise is troubling. We know that the Delta variant has increased transmissibility, and it is currently surging in pockets of the country with low vaccination rates.
But at least much of the U.S. is vaccinated. Much of the world's governments can't vaccinate their own people. And at this point, vaccines are the only way out, as White House COVID coordinator Jeffrey Zients admitted today.
It's another life protected, another community that is safer, and another step toward putting this pandemic behind us that has sadly taken more than 600,000 lives here at home and a total of 4 million lives around the world.
4 million people. And in the 2.5 minutes since this story began, another 15 people died of COVID. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Let's fill in more of the global picture and the struggle to vaccinate as the Delta variant spreads. Dr. Jennifer Nazzo is an epidemiologist who watches this closely at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Global Health Security. Dr. Nazzo, welcome back to the NewsHour. And as we say, someone who has watched this closely from the beginning, what's the significance to you of this 4 million milestone?
I mean, it's just an absolutely staggering, very grim milestone to reach. And it's terrible just to think that we've lost 4 million human beings, but also knowing that that's probably an undercount, because being able to diagnose infection and count deaths is frankly a luxury that a lot of places in the world don't have the ability to do. And I reflect on COVID in 2021, and I think about the fact that we now have in production and availability vaccines, tools that can prevent these deaths. The fact that we have added more deaths since the invention of vaccines for COVID than we had beforehand, it's just an utter tragedy. I mean, these deaths can be prevented if we are able to get vaccines to where they need to go.
And as we saw in that report from Nick Schifrin, the picture in the rest of the world is just utterly grim. The WHO was saying today the continent of Africa this past week, its worst ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the beginning part of this pandemic, there was this false narrative that this was a virus that was only affecting rich countries. And that there were certain countries and parts of the world that were largely spared. We are now seeing that was an absolutely false assumption. And unfortunately, I think it maybe took off some of the pressure to make sure that we not only developed vaccines, but that we developed plans, real operational plans, to make sure we share the vaccines that we do produce. And we are seeing this virus ravage all parts of the globe, and really any country that, as of now, hasn't been able to vaccinate large portions of its population and haven't had a large surge of cases remains perilously at risk. We are seeing the virus surging in parts of the world where they had been previously successful in containing the spread of the virus, but these new variants outpace those efforts. It's very hard to keep up with the traditional public health methods that countries have been using. And really the only pathway to the prevention of this incredible loss of life and to return to normal for the globe is to ensure that all countries have access to vaccines so that they can protect their populations.
Well, how do you get that done? We heard the doctor say in that report, the rest of the world, there's a stockpile of vaccines. What needs to happen? I mean, the U.S. is now shipping, what, 500 million plus doses. Other wealthy countries are shipping some vaccines to poorer countries.
Yeah, so a number of countries have pledged vaccines, which is really important. I mean, the G7 has come up with about a 2 billion vaccine pledge. That is important, and I don't want to undersell what an incredible achievement that is. That said, the estimates are that we need about 5.5 billion vaccines. So first of all, we need to figure out a way to make more and to make more quickly. And the other thing that we need to do is make sure that these pledges turn into actual vaccines shipped to where they need to be going. And unfortunately, some of those efforts are really falling behind schedule. We have a very narrow window of time to act. If I see a proposal for sharing vaccines or making more vaccines that stretches beyond a year, I have to actually question how much of an impact it's going to have, because we need vaccines right now to save the most amount of lives. This virus is moving across the planet really quickly, so it's essential that we get vaccines in arms as quickly as possible. And really, in the next few months, it's going to be absolutely critical.
So you're talking about policy decisions, policy changes at the highest levels here in the United States and in other countries. And then we had the announcement today from Pfizer that it may be within just a few weeks of seeking U.S. authorization for a booster, a third shot, which presumably would be in big demand here in the United States.
Yeah, so I think we have to have some tough conversations about how we're going to use the vaccines that exist on the planet. To date, about 75% of the world's vaccines have been used by only a handful of countries, and they are all high-income countries. I think when we are talking about using vaccines in low priority populations, when we're thinking about, you know, possibly giving a third booster, I think we have to really have a hard look at whether that's an ethical thing to do, or if that's something that we can do later, after some of the world has had an opportunity to protect its most vulnerable, to at least protect their healthcare workers who put their lives on the line every day. If we let countries put their healthcare workers at risk and they lose those healthcare workers, those countries are not going to be ready for future events. The fact that all of us have had to sit home at various points in this pandemic has been because we are acutely concerned about the ability of health systems to be able to respond to a surge of cases. So you can imagine that if we allow healthcare workers to get infected and not be able to care for patients, that countries are just going to be absolutely crippled by that. So, you know, I think we have to have a hard look at how we're using the vaccines that are in existence now. And, you know, in my view, talk about a booster, except for some, you know, very limited populations that we don't think have mounted an immune response from the vaccine doses that they've received to date. I think it's really premature to be talking about that when the vast majority of the world has not even had access to one shot.
Some very, very tough trade-offs that certainly deserve addressing. Dr. Jennifer Nazzo with the Johns Hopkins University Center for Global Health Security. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now that workers searching the rubble of the fallen Surfside condominium have shifted from rescue to recovery, more attention is turning to decisions made before the building's collapse. As Stephanie Tsai tells us, part of the inquiries to come will focus on decisions made by the people who own units there.
Judy, a 2018 engineer's report found major structural damage to the concrete in a number of areas of the complex, requiring an estimated $9 million in upgrades and repairs. But efforts to raise that money stalled as homeowners and their board disagreed over how it might be done. When the building collapsed last month, the price tag had risen to $15 million, and repairs had yet to begin. Evan McKenzie teaches political science and law at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is author of two books on condominium and homeowner associations. Mr. McKenzie, thank you for joining the NewsHour. Based on your area of expertise, what is the larger problem that you think this condo collapse highlights?
I think the larger problem is that we have probably 150,000 condo associations in the country, with tens of millions of people living in them, and they are their finances are not really sufficiently regulated. Nobody really knows what their financial needs are. Nobody knows how many of them are in financial distress, and nobody really knows how many of them will probably need millions more dollars than they actually have access to.
So are you saying there should have been or there should be state mandated requirements for these condo boards? In other words, requirements for keeping enough money in reserve for repairs, because that is what is believed partly led to the delay in repairs in this building.
Yes, definitely. I mean, the state of Florida does not even require condo owners, condo associations and HOAs to obtain professional advice on what their reserve funds should be. They can just assess it, decide what it should be themselves without even having a professional review the situation in their building. And unfortunately, that's the case in almost all states around the country. These boards and their financial decisions are largely unregulated and are almost entirely secret. In other words, we don't even get access to the information. The public doesn't even know what the situation is in these condos as they go shopping for housing.
And I know that one of the former board members had said to the media that he did not believe anyone believed there was an imminent danger. For what it's worth, the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, has said that he doesn't see state action playing a role at this point to look at these older buildings. Beyond that, you point out that condo boards, which are voluntary, are not qualified or experienced enough to make some of the decisions on the maintenance and repair of older buildings. So who do you put the onus on?
Well, you know, the most basic functions of state and local government in our system since the founding of the country have been public safety and control over land use, such as buildings and streets and roads and this sort of thing. And the intersection of that is right here, where buildings are unsafe and collapse and fall down and kill people. That is a fundamental function of state and local government to make sure that things like that never happen. And so I don't know what Governor DeSantis thinks local government is for and state government is for, if it is not for protecting people against this risk. And these these volunteer directors, they have no qualification that is required by law other than just being a unit owner. That's it. And they don't have any support or very little support from anyone except whatever property managers and lawyers they can hire, afford to hire. And so, no, there needs to be a great deal more oversight from government. It doesn't have to be intrusive, but it should be supportive and regulatory, and it should keep them on the path that will safeguard all the owners against catastrophes like this.
You wrote an opinion piece recently, Mr. McKenzie, for the Washington Post. It framed the problem of building safety as a climate change problem because structures like this one in Surfside, for example, may face rising sea levels. How can these condo boards prepare better for those impacts?
Well, you know, the core problem here is that just in taking care of routine maintenance issues, we know that a huge percentage of associations aren't even up to speed on that. On knowing about what wear and tear is going to do to their building and how much it'll cost to fix and when they'll need to have the money. So add to that that there are costs due to climate change that no one ever anticipated, you know, rising seas and landslide risks from heavy rains and wildfires and other things that are much higher risk than before. And, you know, it does require professional opinion. So what they have to do initially is they have to get experts in building to conduct what we call reserve studies, to tell them what they need and to take into account the impact of a climate change on their community. But I also think that they need external help. I mean, they are going to need funding from other levels of government to get them the funds they need, because I don't think they have it themselves or really have access to it.
But we are talking about thousands and thousands of buildings just on that coastline there. And we know that some of the delay in repairs in this case came down to cost. Some people don't necessarily want to pay for repairs until it's too late. And some people can't afford to. And this board is basically a democracy. So what is the solution?
Well, that's the core problem right there. Condo boards and their officers and the members control their own assessment levels, and they can decide to not set enough money aside. And I think the way to do it is to first mandate that reserve studies be done every 3 years and then to publicize the outcome. I think that these reserve studies should be public. They should be available to the public to see. And I think that we should know what percentage of the proper reserves that each association has so that when we go shopping for condos, there's some market pressure and sort of a reward on condo boards and their owners to have the proper reserves. When people see they're in good financial shape, they won't be worried about buying there. But if another building is underfunded, then people will know in advance. And I think we could do that relatively easily.
Evan McKenzie of the University of Illinois at Chicago, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Texas legislature gaveled back to order today for a special session to address a laundry list of Republican priorities left undone when lawmakers left Austin in May. Chief among them, an update of the state's voting laws. Lisa Desjardins has the story.
Judy, Democrats in Texas blocked the last voting bill by walking out of the chamber before a deadline. Now Republicans are back with a new version, House Bill 3. It includes ID requirements for mail-in ballots and a ban on 24-hour and drive-through voting. But this version drops some previous ideas to limit Sunday voting. The debate over voting rights remains hot. Vice President Harris weighed in on the Texas bill today during a speech in Washington.
You know what's going on in Texas right now. This all is designed, I believe, to make it harder for you to vote so that you don't vote.
But Republicans, including the bill's original sponsor, reject that argument. Here's State Senator Brian Hughes in a recent interview with the NewsHour.
I hear that generalization, but no one has shown me any evidence of it. This bill says that in those urban counties, that the polling places have to be distributed evenly across the county. Now, that's just straight up fairness based on where the voters live, regardless of their race, of their party, of their ethnic background, their religion. This is about making the system fair for all voters.
State Representative Chris Turner is chair of the Texas House Democratic Caucus and led the walkout in May that blocked that other voting bill. He joins me now. Representative Turner, Republicans say they are determined to pass new voting laws. Can you block them this time, and how? Our audience likes specifics.
As you know, Democrats were successful in blocking this anti-voter legislation at the end of our regular session, as you've already told your viewers. And what I can tell you is that today, on the first day of this special session, Democrats in the House and the Senate here in Texas are more unified than ever, more determined than ever to do all we can to block Republican attempts to make it more difficult to vote in the state of Texas, a state that is already very difficult to vote in because we already have very restrictive voting laws on the books. So we're going to fight every step of the way. We are going to leave no stone unturned in our mission to defend the rights of our constituents to cast ballots in a free and safe and secure election. We are going to take it a day at a time. And Republicans can expect a big fight from us on these bills.
You know, since you walked out, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has ruled in favor of Republicans and some restrictions they want on voting laws in other states. Also, there's more conservative pressure on your Republican governor. Could you have opened a Pandora's box here? Could it be that Republicans may be more bold now about voting restrictions and limits?
Look, I think you're absolutely right that our governor is reacting to his 2022 primary election, where he already has two opponents in the Republican primary. He's just simply in a race to the bottom with but not only his primary opponents, but I think other Republican leaders around the country in trying to appeal to and placate Donald Trump and the Donald Trump base, which is essentially now is the Republican Party. So that's a real factor that we have to contend with because Republicans control all levers of government in Texas presently. But I think that with respect to the court decision, while that was obviously not the decision any of us wanted to see, it's very important for Republicans to remember Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act remains intact. The court decision did not in any way nullify Section 2 like they did with Section 5 several years ago. And so we still have a constitution in this country. We still have a Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And Republicans in Texas shamefully have a track record of passing laws that have been found by federal courts to be intentionally discriminatory against African-American and Hispanic voters in Texas under both the Voting Rights Act and the Constitution. Whether that's redistricting plans over the last decade, our photo voter ID law, Greg Abbott, Secretary of State, 2 years ago attempted a voter purge that federal courts had to stop. There is a track record in Texas of Republicans violating the Voting Rights Act and the Constitution. There's a track record of courts continually defending and pushing back on those Republican attempts. So they ought to be cautious about what they try to do.
One final question. The Speaker of the House there in Texas has the power to compel, use state troopers to force members back into the chamber, trying to avoid what you did last time. This is a serious question. Is this issue worth yourself moving to another state or hiding out to avoid that?
You're right. The Speaker definitely has the power to compel a quorum. I think it's debatable how he can go about doing that or how any speaker can go about doing that. But the Speaker does have authority to compel a quorum. What I would say is that, those discussions, it would be premature right now to speculate. We're never going to take anything off the table at the same time. And as I say, it's a 30-day session. It will go quickly. We're going to take it a day at a time and make the best decisions we can day by day.
I didn't hear a no there. It sounds like it's going to be a hot summer there in Texas. Representative Chris Turner of the House Democratic Caucus in Texas, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up on the NewsHour, Canada confronts the discovery of hundreds of unmarked graves at a former Indigenous school. And Japan prepares to host the Olympics under the shadow of COVID-19. Now, we continue our look at generational tensions in our country over economic disparities. The COVID-19 shutdown and recession may have exacerbated an already growing division in popular culture between millennials and baby boomers. Tonight, we hear from that older generation and from our own economics correspondent, Paul Salmon.
No matter what you actually accomplish or feel like you accomplish, you don't feel like you're actually moving forward in life. It's like
the millennials lament. We heard it last night from a group of millennials.
2020 came, still had no income. So we were living with my parents.
I still feel like I'm behind the eight ball.
And the pandemic has only made economic matters worse, even for our group of college grads, a group hit much less hard than those without higher degrees.
Renting is basically all I kind of see for my wife and I for the foreseeable future.
This one goes out to all the 65 plus crowd on SoundCloud.
So who to blame? More and more these days, it's okay, boomer.
Okay, boomer, okay, boomer, okay, boomer, okay, boomer.
That is the baby boom, roughly those of us born between the end of World War II and 1964, is fingered as the culprit. So tonight, we give my generation the right of reply.
Beating up on baby boom, it's sort of the last acceptable prejudice.
Professor Lenny Steinhorn wrote The Greater Generation in defense of the baby boom legacy 15 years ago, when blame was already being assigned.
You know, you see all of these essays and all of these articles and all of these people going on TV criticizing baby boomers as if they're somehow singularly selfish or narcissistic or the me generation and all of that. And so I wanted to be able to correct the record, correct the history, and put it in historical context.
Part of the context, says Steinhorn, 65, is pure luck, growing up in a booming economy, as a group of boomer panelists we assembled happily did. Like Joe Ferreira, 56, a high school history teacher in Massachusetts.
When I left school, I had no debt on my shoulders. And the total amount after my second graduate degree that I had in debt was literally a $1,000 personal loan.
Bert Fohr was a classmate of mine at Brandeis University, became a lawyer, founded the American Antitrust Institute.
When it came time to get jobs in college, the government was hiring and there were jobs in the government. And we had that advantage because of a growing economy, a booming economy, if you will.
Norma McKay from the Chicago suburbs, a retired software engineer.
I have five job offers without me doing any bit of work. I got offers from IBM, Bell Laboratories, Rockwell International, Sun Microsystems. I got to reject IBM. That was really something.
Allison Adderley, a 62-year-old community college professor in Orlando, Florida.
I bought my first house when I was 24.
How much did it cost?
$51,000.
That home has about tripled in value. By contrast,
you have to lower your expectation. It's not viable.
When we were their age, there was less inequality, homes were cheaper, the middle class stronger, taxes on the wealthy higher. Climate, outsourcing, offshoring, no issue. So did our panelists feel guilty about what's happened on our watch?
I want to apologize because I don't feel we're leaving a better world for them. I guess we shoulder all the blame, right? Because we're the people that were in charge.
I feel somewhat guilty, like we dropped the ball.
The other half of the panel, however, disagreed.
I don't feel guilty because I believe that it was just circumstance that put us at that time period. I do feel responsible. I don't feel guilty.
I don't buy this generational guilt at all. I think that we were lucky. We were on a ladder that was going up with no help from us. The ladder meant that things, assets, were increasing in value in ways that they are not today.
So you don't feel guilty about the tax cuts, the offshoring, the things that you think have put millennials at a disadvantage?
I've probably opposed all of those things during the last 40 years. So I don't feel guilty about it. I feel frustrated. I wanted to leave a better world for my kids and grandkids.
But boomers voted for the folks who pushed these policies, no?
Politically, you have a very diverse country, and people vote for any number of reasons at that particular point in time.
In fact, since the 1980s, boomers have by and large split about evenly in presidential elections. So about half of us voted for tax cuts and freer markets, half not. Half our panel feels guilty, half not. And look, says Steinhorn,
economic change is often beyond the control of a generation because you're living through it. you're managing, you're trying to raise a family, you're trying to sort of support yourself, you're trying to put a roof over your head and food on the table and have a meaningful, if you can, livelihood in that matter.
Instead of feeling guilty, he argues that baby boomers have plenty to be proud of.
Fundamentally, the baby boom generation took on the outdated norms of the generation before and began to transform America.
Sure, the greatest generation survived the Depression, helped win World War II, but that's not their whole legacy, says Steinhorn.
They were the ones who chose to move into the Levittowns and exclude black people from those suburbs, who continued to deny the rights of women, to, you know, force gay people to go through implosive therapy or electroshock therapy because they didn't fit in. So the baby boom generation saw that and fundamentally changed it.
Civil rights, feminism, LGBTQ, and disability rights. No panel has felt guilty about this history.
I am very proud. Yeah, you know, demonstrations on campus, peaceful demonstrations. I was there every day at lunchtime.
We may not have brought it to complete fruition, but we started a lot of it. I, as a baby boomer, I'm going to take some credit for that as I take some blame for the other stuff as well.
But what about the existential threat that millennials will face after we're long gone? Global warming.
Under baby boomers' watch, did this happen? Sure, but this is something that's been going on for 175 years since the dawn of the industrial era, and we are really fully realizing the consequences of all of that now. So to say that one generation is responsible for that, that's ahistorical.
And please don't forget, says Steinhorn,
it was the baby boom generation that basically motivated Earth Day and jump-started the environmental movement.
So then how valid is it to generalize about one generation at all?
You have to look at history as a far more complex phenomenon than the sort of generational divide that is really artificial is framing right now. So why are we pitting a generation against each other when in fact all they're basically doing is pointing a finger at baby boomers for a few bad mistakes that took place during those years, not recognizing how society has transformed since the 1950s in fundamental, deep, institutional, personal, interpersonal ways.
Bert Fuhr agreed.
You can't blame one generation because one generation never has power, at least not for much time.
Allison Adderley?
I agree. You cannot group any, whole group of people together and say that they all think alike.
But as a member of the generation that popularized the phrase, don't trust anyone over 30, there is one part of the millennial critique that Steinhorn applauds.
I think okay boomer is a great phrase. I think every younger generation should stick their thumb in the eye of their elders and poke them and prod them and basically say, okay, stop giving us your wisdom and stop telling us what to do. It's our turn now and we're going to do it.
Handing off the baton with some relief then. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
The shocking discoveries of several hundred unmarked graves at former boarding schools for Indigenous children in Western Canada has focused attention on a dark chapter of that nation's history. As John Yang reports, it is a story of forced assimilation and physical, emotional, and sexual abuse.
Judy, for more than a century, the children of Canadian Native communities, including what's known as the First Nations, were taken from their families and sent to Christian boarding schools run for the government, about 70% of them run by the Catholic Church. An estimated 150,000 children passed through these schools before they were closed in 1996. They were banned from speaking their languages or practicing their traditions. Children died and their families were never told, their bodies never returned. After the discovery of these graves over the last 6 weeks, Indigenous leaders have demanded an investigation into what they call a crime against humanity. Heather Baer is vice chief of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous First Nations, which represents 74 First Nations in Saskatchewan. She joins us from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. Vice Chief Baer, thanks so much for being with us. I understand you went to one of these schools. What can you tell us about your experience and what it was like?
This has shaken shaken our country, not only First Nations, but many non-First Nations, government leaders, professionals, and I think just every corner of our country has now been impacted with this new awareness that is not new. This has always been, these stories have all been told. What's coming out with this is the real story, and we need to change that legacy because it's a very dark legacy, a dark history of First Nations when we talk about the abuse and the horrendous crimes against children. At the time that I went was after 1972, the Chief's Task Force in Saskatchewan, Indian Control of Indian Education, that was something that happened. So the transition was happening where First Nations were starting to operate these schools and the churches were transitioning out. However, there still was that lonely, heavy feeling that you can't really explain it. You have to be there. But also tied to that was the oral tradition, the stories, the whispers, the what the students and teachers would talk about in terms of what had happened at those schools and the hauntings. It was a very haunting experience, especially when you look outside your window and there's a cemetery. And I'm naming Maryville School. And I remember the swing set in the playground, just a few steps away, you were looking at a cemetery. So I asked the question, how many schools do you see with cemeteries in their yards? It should have been playgrounds.
What does this do? You talk about sort of the legacy of this and the and I imagine with these new discoveries in these past several weeks, it's sort of re-traumatizing. What's the sort of the impact on generations and generations of Indigenous people in Canada?
You know, I could probably sit here for 100 years and not be able to explain or talk about the impacts because they're so huge. And they're at different levels. You have your survivors who are directly impacted that still live today, whether it be sexual abuse, physical, mental, spiritual, language abuse, not being able to speak your mother tongue, not being able to pray, to be told, you know, you're not human, you're inhuman if you didn't take on this Christianity. And like I say, you know, the... what's going on right now, I think when you look at the impacts, there's direct impacts that are, and there's impacts that are intergenerational. And like today, you still have addictions. You still have, you know, family violence. You still have poverty.
70% of these schools were run or started by the Catholic Church. The Vatican has announced that they're going to have three of the biggest Indigenous groups coming to the Vatican, going to the Vatican at the end of the year to meet with the Pope. Is that enough, this sort of meeting, and what do you want to come out of that meeting?
Well, contrary to what the Pope says, he believes that that's not their role to give an apology according to their structure. But I believe as a leader, as leaders, I think we have to take responsibility and accountability. And when we talk about healing, you know, doesn't the good book talk about forgiveness and, you know, in terms of our healing, we need to forgive, but we need that church to apologize and admit the harms that they've done so that we as Indigenous people, as survivors of residential school, you know, can at least turn to you and have that opportunity to forgive and get on that long, hard journey of healing and surviving. I mean, there's great accountability. They're a great leader. These were men of the cloth that abused our children. They're men of the cloth that were perpetrators who perpetrated the most horrendous crimes against children. I mean, I think the church owes the Indigenous peoples of this country, I'm certain, you know, with all the transgressions, they owe us something back in the name of healing.
Heather Bear, Vice Chief of the Federation of Indigenous First Nations in Saskatchewan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The decision today to bar all spectators from attending Olympic events in Tokyo comes just 2 weeks before the Games are set to begin. Organizers once hoped the Games would be a global showcase for Japan. But there has been widespread opposition within the country to hosting them during the pandemic. Only 15% of Japan's population is fully vaccinated. And there is concern that cases are rising again this summer. More than $20 billion have already been committed to pulling off these Olympics. For a look at all of this, I'm joined by Christine Brennan, a sports columnist for USA Today. She will be going to Tokyo to cover her 19th Olympics. And Sheila Smith, a senior fellow for Asia-Pacific Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she has written extensively about Japan. It's so good to have both of you with us. Thank you for joining us. Christine, I'm going to start with you. Why the organizers' decision today to say not only foreign tourists can come to sit and watch these Olympics, but no one, not even Japanese residents?
Judy, they have declared a state of emergency that will run through the entire Olympic Games. This is exactly what the International Olympic Committee was not planning when it postponed the Games last March during the height of the, as the pandemic was starting. But here we are. And so you've got a state of emergency, you've got COVID cases rising in Tokyo and the surrounding area, and you've got basically, what, 15 to 20% of Japanese residents completely fully vaccinated. And it was a very slow process to vaccinate the population in Japan. They were very slow off the mark. So now you've got this situation where you just can't trust it. You just can't put people in those venues. And even as the athletes of the world show up, there will be some who are not vaccinated. We don't know how many, but certainly there will be unvaccinated athletes coming into Japan, and the risk is too great. And it truly is a shame because this is the greatest regularly scheduled peacetime gathering of the world. The Olympic Games are the youth of the world coming together for good, for sport. And of course, this is a gathering that will have no gathering because the athletes can't even mix. And you can't have those scenes in the square with television sets and everyone together in a glorious celebration. It's a very, very unfortunate.
And Sheila, we are reading that the Japanese public didn't want the Games to go forward. Why did the Japanese government say yes? The Games will go forward despite all these restrictions. And what kind of pressure were they under from the International Olympic Committee?
So thank you, Judy. I think it's really been hard for Prime Minister Suga and his cabinet to try to balance both the COVID pandemic and the management of that pandemic with the real investment, both in financial terms, but also in expectations for these Olympics. The Japanese people largely love the Olympic Games and were delighted when Tokyo was selected to host them. But as the pandemic became more severe and as the consequences of that pandemic for this year's Games became more acute, not only in Japan, but around the world, I think the Japanese public has really turned sour on the idea that they should be hosting them. As you pointed out in your opening piece, about 85% of the Japanese public feel that they should be postponed once again or canceled altogether. I think what's at stake is obviously a lot of government investment. These Olympic Games for cities, for countries, are not inexpensive endeavors. But there's also the idea that they could showcase Japan to the world, to show a renewed Japan, a technologically sophisticated Japan, and Japanese culture to the world.
Christine, bringing it back to the International Olympic Committee, they've been pushing very hard for these Games to go forward. Why?
So much money. It's all about the money. It's all about billions of dollars. Sponsorship. It's about the Olympic committees that need that money as well. Basically, a Summer Olympics or a Winter Olympics, which will happen in Beijing in 6 months, it funds everything. And there's also, in addition to that, obviously that's a very big reason, just the financial reason, and that's why it's going to look like a TV show, and they almost don't, they care about not having fans, but not really. They want the show to go on, the television show to go on. It could be in a soundstage, really. But also, I think you've got the hubris of the International Olympic Committee, and that is not breaking news. We are talking about people who, in some cases, are royalty in Europe, or they think they're royalty. They stay at the finest hotels and they have the biggest per diems and the great meals, and they're the ones, the Lords of the Rings, that run the Olympics. And they're not going to have anything but their Olympic Games. And I'm wondering for the future, if we look back at this time, maybe 20, 30 years from now, if the Olympics really struggle, we may look at this as this, again, this confidence bordering on hubris, the sense that we will do this no matter what, and come what may. And we'll see, of course, what comes what may over the next month or so.
And Sheila, you were starting to talk about what's at stake for the Japanese, for the organizers, for the country. It's their reputation, and they have to be worried about safety.
Absolutely, Judy. I think the government is on tenterhooks here. It's important to point out that the numbers of COVID-19 cases in Japan are still far less than they are here in the United States or in India, for example. But nonetheless, the Japanese people are very worried that this is going to be some kind of super spreader event that the government will not be able to manage. And of course, the stake for Prime Minister Suga and his political party are also very high. There's a lower house election scheduled for October, and getting to the other side of these games safely is going to be very, very important for his political future.
Christine, I want to come back to something you said in your first answer about how different this is going to be for the athletes themselves. What is going to be different? As we mentioned, you've covered, 18 of these Olympic Games before, but what will be different for them?
There's no ability to go out on the town with family or friends after their events or during their events. There's no mingling with the other athletes. The joy of a Canadian being able to sit next to an Indian who's sitting next to an Australian, who's sitting next to a German athletes, all different sports, having lunch or dinner. That can't happen. They cannot sit in the dining hall and enjoy that social time. And when you talk to athletes, as you and I have, Judy, over the years, Olympians from the past, they talk about that, the deep friendships that they made, again, in the village. Can't happen, because you cannot have the risk, COVID, of course, is part of it, but also the contact tracing. You know, someone goes and does that, and then there's, of course, the tracing, the apps, we'll all have them. They'll be watching us, our every move. And then you go back to your dorm, your Olympic Village hallway, and you contact trace your roommates right out of their event. It sounds like that could be dramatic and maybe won't happen. I certainly hope it doesn't happen, Judy, but it could. And that's why it's going to be a very austere and Spartan Olympic Games, where these athletes compete and then they go home. None of the celebration, the joie de vivre that we're so used to at an Olympic Games.
And just quickly, Christine, the opening ceremony, the closing ceremony, they're still going to have that?
They are. There will be no fans. As we understand it, the athletes may come in. Again, they've got to keep them apart from other countries, which is unusual. Come in, walk around the track, have a wave to empty seats, and then walk right back out and get them back safely to their dorm rooms. Again, a TV show more than anything else.
Christine Brennan, Sheila Smith, the games begin in just a little more than 2 weeks. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Judy.
And on the NewsHour online, a slew of ransomware attacks have rocked the U.S., leaving both the corporate sector and government officials scrambling to address the growing threat. We look into the attacks and what can be done to stop them. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.